So here we are, it's Wednesday, it's the 12th of March 2014. We're reading the Larger Puran Sutra. We've got four of Amida's, of Dharmakara's vows left to look at, and then and then there's some more of the sutra after that. So remember, the vows are all Dharmakara saying, if I'm not enlightened, this won't come true. And then later on, we find out that he is enlightened, so we know all of these vows have come true and are at work. So some of them describe the qualities of Amida, some of them describe the qualities of his Purand, some of them describe the qualities of people that come into contact with him. So the 45th vow, it's called the Samadhi of Universal Equality, and it says, O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, bodhisattvas of Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name should not attain the Samadhi of Universal Equality, and in that state be conscious of the innumerable, inconceivable Tathagatas. So beings, bodhisattvas, people on the spiritual path, people of made a vow to help other beings, even if they're not pure and Buddhists, you know, if they're disciples of Medicine Buddha or anybody else. If they hear the name of Amida, they should be able to enter a state where they can see all the Buddhas around them. So, and you could say, you know, Tathagata refers to somebody who embodies things as they are, but I guess you could also take it further and say, you know, it also, if you can see, if you become aware of a teacher who embodies things as they are, or who sees things as they are, the underlying reality of the world himself, in this kind of encounter that I think this vow is talking about, you also are given an experience of seeing things as they are, which here is described as the Samadhi of Universal Equality, the vision of universal equality. So it's about, Samadhi is about seeing things in a particular way. And this is about seeing things in a way that doesn't measure them. Each thing is valued equally in the eyes of a Buddha. Each thing is loved equally in the eyes of a Buddha. This is saying, if you say, if you recite the Buddha's name, if you're a disciple of any Buddha and you recite the Buddha's name, this state of being where you're able to see people and things with the loving eyes of a Buddha and see the Buddhas for what they are will come to you. Describing a particular kind of spiritual experience that can be the fruits of one of these practices. And the next vow is in a similar vein, really, and it sort of it explicitly says what I just said a few minutes ago. O Blessed One, may I not come to the complete awakening if, when I have done so, bodhisattvas of my land cannot hear the Dharma spontaneously just as they wish. So you could take this to have two meanings. One is that you, once you enter Pure Land, once you come into the space of a Buddha, you will have access to the teachings, this sort of teaching that I'm holding written down, the formal teachings of the Buddha, the discourses that have been passed down to us. They'll be accessible to you. But Dharma also means truth. It's like a synonym for Tathagata is a person who embodies the truth. The Dharma is that truth that they embody, things as they are. So this is about when you're in a pure land, you may not be listening to the Buddha reciting one of the sutras, but actually even just the way that he picks up his biscuit, you'll be able to see that as a teaching. It doesn't necessarily mean that he'll be picking up his biscuit in the best way to pick up a biscuit, although sometimes he might be, but that everything that you encounter in the world will be enlightening, will be awakening. There'll be a lesson, a chance of liberation in every encounter with everything that you have, with every conversation that you have. If you listen deeply to a person, there's the opportunity for you to become awakened in that conversation. And that's a state of receptivity that comes through having a deep faith and comes through having a connection with the Buddha. It's like once that connection is already established, once that thread between you and Amida is already established, you take that into the world, and maybe thread is the not the best analogy. It's like when you, as you start to build your relationship with the Buddha, it's like he gives you a particular pair of glasses, like the Nembutsu is building a pair of glasses for you. And when you put those on, everything that you see becomes a teaching, a possible teaching for enlightenment. And the more you do your practice, the more you stay in tune with the Buddha, the better those glasses become. It's perhaps still not a perfect metaphor, but hopefully it gives some sense of what this that particular vow is about. The 47th vow is about non-retrogression. And Dharmavijaya said about this in his notes that there's some controversy, maybe controversy is too strong a word, discussion and debate within Buddhism as to which level of spiritual maturity counts as non-retrogression and when one enters the stream and so forth. Where is it in your experience that you cross a threshold after which you can't go back? Non-retrogression is the idea that once you reach a particular point of spiritual maturity, you can't go back from that point. So the vow says, O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, bodhisattvas of Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name should not dwell in the state of non-retrogression. And there's a lot of negatives in that, in the way that vow is expressed. So if you strip them all out. O blessed one, may I come to awakening if when I have done so, bodhisattvas of Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name do dwell in the state of non-retrogression, would be the positive way of putting it. So people who practice the Pure Land way, who hear Amida Buddha, who see the Dharma in the way that's described in the previous one, who are on that kind of path. Once you've had an awakening of faith, that changes you from that point onwards. Now, you may have the experience of going back into your old ways after you've had an awakening of faith, but that seed that wasn't there before is still in you. Even if you go back into your old ways, it doesn't destroy the faith that, you know, it might sully or cover up the faith that you have, but there is still something of that that remains. And I don't think you go completely back. And I guess, you know, you could have a conversation about at what point does that happen? Is there a point you reach in your spiritual practice in this lifetime beyond which it becomes impossible to go back to how things were before? It's like, did you ever see The Matrix where Morpheus says to Neo, you take the red pill, you go down the rabbit hole, you take the blue pill and you wake up as if nothing's ever happened?
I saw the film, but I couldn't understand it.
Well, the point of that is essentially he's saying, if you take this pill, you'll wake up, you'll see things that are true that you wouldn't see before. And once you've seen them, you can't forget them. If you take this other pill, you'll forget that we ever had this conversation and you'll go back to living your mundane life as it was before. And that's quite a good metaphor for non-retrogression in a way. It's saying once you've tasted the Dharma, you can't go back to your life as it was before. And if you do, something will niggle at you and will hook you back. The Dharma will pull you back into a different kind of life. You know, non-retrogression. Is it helpful idea? Well, maybe it's helpful in the sense that it supports our faith, and it gives us a sense that actually even when things go wrong, we've still got something that we didn't have before. And that's my experience. You know, I can't speak for everybody's experience, but I couldn't go back to being the person that I was 10 years ago. Well, I can't, even if my life were to change, the way in which it would change would be conditioned by my experience of faith. That would, it would be impossible not to be. So there's something about, you know, there was a question about a progression last week, and this implies that there is progression in the spiritual path. There is a movement from a state of ignorance to a state of awakening. And even if you go back into being a bit ignorant again, there's something in you that remains awake. Now, we also, you know, the answer to that question was that we're not responsible for the awakening. Actually, that happened, that comes as a grace to us. So we don't take any credit for walking along the spiritual path or for becoming somebody who's got this quality. It's a gift from Amida. And the 48th vow, which is the final vow, is sort of about what happens, what if you extend that journey, that non-retrogression, if you keep on that path of faith, where do you go? O blessed one, may I not come to the complete awakening if when I have done so, bodhisattvas of Buddha lands throughout the 10 directions who listen to my name should not immediately attain serene acceptance of the Dharma and cross a threshold of non-retrogression. In seeking their commitment to seeking the qualities of a Buddha. So this goes beyond just the state of non-retrogression that I talked about. It's actually not only will you you cross a threshold from which it's impossible to go back from, but you'll cross another threshold, and that threshold is the mind of bodhicitta, the mind that desires enlightenment. And if you keep practicing this, you'll be given serene acceptance of the Dharma. You'll begin to accept that things are the way they are in your own life. And at that point, naturally, the desire to become a Buddha or to seek the qualities of a Buddha, as Hare puts it here, will arise in you. Now, that path isn't necessarily something that we choose to do in a conscious way. Something is more like, it's more like the parable of the white path. There's Shan Dao, who's a Chinese Pure Land Buddhist, who wrote the commentary on this sutra, or the smaller sutra, I'm not sure now, that Honan read and had his great awakening. He talked about a Buddhist parable of the white path. There's somebody's running through a forest, and there's bandits on one side of the path, and there's lions and tigers on the other side of the path, and essentially they have to keep going. They can't go backwards, and they can't go left and right. And they come to a ravine or a river, and there's a very narrow white path that stretches from one side of the bank to the other side of the bank. But on the one side of the white path, one side of the bridge, the water is water, raging water. On the other side is fire. So this bridge goes across the point in the river where the river changes from fire to water. He goes, okay, well, if I walk across that path, I could very easily slip and fall into the water and drown, or I could slip and fall into the fire and burn. If I stay here on the path, I'm either going to get eaten by the tigers or killed by the bandits. And he hears one voice behind him saying, go on, you just one step at a time, you can do it, take a little step. And another one, and another one. And he starts to step onto the path, and then he hears a voice from in front of him on the other side of the riverbank calling him forwards. In the parable, the rivers represent greed and hatred, the different, the fire and the water. And the voice whispering in his ear from behind him is Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha of the past, saying, go on, just go forwards, you know, teaching from the past. And the voice on the other side of the river calling him forwards is Amida Buddha. Now, there is some choice in that situation for the person who's on the riverbank, but actually, it's not a great choice, you know. So he makes the only choice that's available, the only sensible choice that's available to him, which is to listen to the Buddha. And the more he listens to the Buddha, the more inevitable it becomes that he's going to cross the white path and keep listening to the Buddha. And if he keeps doing that, his life is transformed. You know, he reaches the other shore of enlightenment. And this idea of non-retrogressional, this idea of a spiritual path is a bit like this, really. It's not... it's not that we make a great effort to cross the stream, although we do take some steps, but it would be impossible to cross that if we didn't have the voices in front and the voices behind us. That's what pulls us forwards across the stream. So I'm, you know, the reason I'm saying that is, I guess, one, to illustrate how precious the Dharma is, but also it's a sort of gift to us, and not, we didn't create the white path, we didn't create the voices calling us forwards, we didn't create the voice whispering in our ear. When we're thinking, you know, it's these ideas about non-retrogression and about spiritual maturity that we can, our ego can easily take hold of and think, well, I've had that experience, I've got that now, I'm spiritually better than these people. They might go backwards, but I've done my Pure Land practice, there's no going back for me. But, you know, the only reason we have these experiences of grace or of bliss or of spontaneously hearing the Dharma just as we wish is because of Amida on the one side and Shakyamuni on the other side. So it's really quite unrealistic to take any of the credit for that. So I'm going to pause there this evening. That's the four vows done. And when we come back to this, we'll be looking at the text we read together earlier this evening, the confirmation of great vows, where Dharmakara re-establishes his resolve, restates his will to become a Buddha on the back of these 48 great vows.